This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Future teachers of history say Black History Month is crucially important.
When you learn about these people that went through struggles that's way worse than what we're going through, it shows you that we can persevere and we have the power if we all come together to make change.
ISU history major Christian Johnson says the movements surrounding historic figures matter just as much as the individuals who made history. Plus, how math and art can work together. McLean County Board Chair John McIntyre talks about how to spend tax revenue from marijuana sales, and the All-American Rejects are not something you'd want to reject. John Norton offers you their music. All that and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. One of the most memorable Super Bowl ads this year came from Google, celebrating Black History Month by showing how many of the world's most searched people are Black people. It showed Black history isn't about the past.
Welcome to the very first National Oprah Winfrey Show!
The future of Black History Month will soon be in the hands of Tatiana Walker and Christian Johnson, two history majors of color at Illinois State University. They want to teach history after graduation. WGLT student reporter Tiffany Jackson asks what they learned when they were kids about Black history.
I had to actually take a African-American history course to actually learn. It was never really in my history courses. And when it was told from a victor's perspective, in the sense that America did what was necessary. So knowing that I know now, it was not good history, if you ask me.
For me, I don't even remember it being taught, really. We talk about slavery and things of that nature, but we didn't really cover it like I think we should have, so.
So how much of Black History Month is about what happened since the 20th century? And do you think there should be an evolution of what's being taught for the new generations?
I do think there needs to be a transition. Talk more progressive in the things, the positive things that were also done in history. I think that gets overlooked. Persevering through slavery was also positive, but we also have people that have created different inventions that we don't talk about as much. So I think as we move forward, I think we should talk more about the inventions and the other things that were created. I think that would be motivating for the students coming up.
For me, I think there just needs to be more incorporation. I think it's not limited to just slavery and civil rights. And so I think when we're talking about Black history, it needs to be incorporated throughout and not just limited to slavery and civil rights. I think students kind of tune out when it doesn't relate to them. And so it just needs to be incorporated more, if that makes sense.
Some people have mentioned the patterns of historical figures like Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks being the faces of Black history, and how other figures like Malcolm X or Huey Newton tend to have bad connotations associated with them. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think about that? And do you think that correlates with the idea of censorship, or is it simply the others had a better light?
I think the others had a better light pertaining to white culture. So white culture, if they are in control of the media, they're going to put different people in different lights. Some people will see Martin Luther King as more conforming to society, and you can see Malcolm X as trying to get out of society. So it makes sense why one has a positive light and one doesn't. But I think we do need to change how we look at figures like Malcolm X, because he was a big reason of why we are here today. He might not have the message of conforming or coming together with the white community, but he put something in us that was positive, and I think we should praise him a little bit more.
Tati, what do you think about that?
I think that when we're talking about these different figures, we need to keep in mind something that we're always taught in university is historical empathy. So understanding the figure for its time and what was going on in that time. There's figures like A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin and just SNCC and the NAACP and all these different organizations and figures that I feel like are important that I didn't learn about in high school or in middle school, really. And so I feel like those are the kind of things that need to be covered when we're talking about the civil rights movement or just Black history.
When you all become teachers, what will you include when it comes to teaching about Black History Month? I'm sure wherever you work, there will be some things that are required for you to teach, but what will you sort of throw in there to ensure that all aspects of it is covered to the fullest?
So for me, I think longer lessons. Black, it's so much in Black history that we can actually break down. So I would actually try to do more trivia, you know, try to challenge the kids. So if they don't know someone, they can go look them up. You know, that's the goal. So, yeah, those are ways that I would incorporate it in my class.
Tati?
For me, I think I wouldn't limit it to just 1 month. I would, like you were saying, longer lessons. But I think for my curriculum, I would include it throughout history, because it is throughout history. It is not just 1 month. And I would really just want my students to understand how diverse our history is. So I would try to include that throughout.
How do you think social media has played a role in what's being learned about Black history today?
From what I see, I see us using social media to actually shine a light on different figures that don't get enough attention. And social media can also be used as a debate, and it can open people's minds to different perspectives. Yeah, someone might say something that's crazy or that's not out of the norm, but it can open up different dialogues. So I think social media can be used well for Black History Month, or just talking about different figures in African American history.
Going off that, I agree. I don't think that social media is a negative, but I think it's important that we're not limiting our knowledge to just social media. When we see something on social media, that you should be intrigued and you should want to look further into it. So I think social media is a great platform, but it definitely, when you're looking at it, you need to expand on it.
What role does the Black Lives Matter group play in the topic of Black history today? Do you see their presence becoming worth mentioning as the subject is taught in the future?
I say 100%, because the killings of African-American children by police was a very big epidemic, and it's probably still going on. It's going on today still, but I think The Black Lives Matter brought shone a light on it that we needed. That was something that was occurring. So for in my classes, I would definitely talk about them during the, and when I'm talking about African American, I'll talk about them in a sociology class too. You know, so I would definitely talk about Black Lives Matter, because they shined a light on it, a very important issue.
Yeah, I would definitely talk about Black Lives Matter. It's important, but I would also talk about political engagement. And I think that's, you know, a way for students to see like how people got involved and did something for what they believed in, and they stood up for something that was important to them. But I would want my students to understand like policy ends. I think when we're dealing with these issues, we need policy set in place to combat these issues that we're facing. And so I would really want to stress that to my students.
How can we do a better job of teaching kids about these major Black history figures? How do we capture the nuanced humanity and flaws of who they were overall?
I think a better way to look at these historians is look at the issues that they were involved in. Rosa Parks, for example, why did she get on the bus? You know, instead of just saying she was the person that got on mm-hmm. the bus and got arrested. You know, so I would you break them down and tell their story, so it shows a level of relevance, and just not me throwing facts at you, but why this connects to you and why this historian connects to you.
There has to be, when we teach about Rosa Parks, we need to understand, you know, the organization that she stood with or that helped implement what she did. There's so much more to it. And it, like you said, it shouldn't just be about teaching facts, for sure.
When it comes to the information that is included in the textbook that we learned from today, some people have questioned the validity. It's been a lot of controversy about what's true, what's false, and what's missing. Do you believe that teachers should have some type of input when it comes to what they're required to teach through that textbook?
You can't just teach from a textbook. There's so much more to cover. And, you know, it's kind of like, what are your students going to be interested in? What's going to really, you know, engage them in learning about history? And when you just teach from a textbook, you are just teaching facts. And, okay, you need to know this, and you need to know this movement. You need to know this organization. And it's not nearly enough.
For me, I just read a book called Lies My Teachers yep. Told Me, and where he literally dissected books and like saw where like heroism, where basically the history basically told from the victor's point of view, you know what I'm saying? We had to do what we had to do. So I would question the validity of a textbook, but the first thing you have to do is study the authors who created the textbook, because that would tell you their interpretations and their perspectives. So like my partner said, you use the textbooks as starting points, like she said. So you can take important things from these textbooks, but it shouldn't be your total things, because at the end of the day, it's just those historians' point of view. They put their interpretation of facts on it. So yes, I would challenge every textbook I have.
Yeah. So when we're teaching history, it's common to teach the master narrative, and heroification is something that he talked about, where we're taking these figures and we're taking the humanity out of them and we're making them heroes, and we're not understanding that they are people, and it's much more complicated and complex. So I think it's important to definitely not stick to just the textbook.
Why do you all believe teaching Black history is still relevant today?
I think it's relevant today because we struggle with some of the same problems. It puts like a different type of confidence in you when you learn about these people that went through struggles that's way worse than what we're going through today, that it shows you that we can persevere and we have the power if we all come together to make change. So for me, seeing my ancestors go through slavery, I have a confidence in me that I can get through any struggle as long as I keep fighting and, you know, keep getting the help that I need. So for me, I think I want to uplift my students with the African American history.
That's Illinois State University history education majors Christian Johnson and Tatiana Walker speaking with WGLT student reporter Tiffany Jackson about Black History Month.
Support for GLT comes from Heritage Health Therapy and Senior Care, exclusive providers of Restore Therapy. Restore Therapy, where your rehab and independence mean more. On the web at heritageofcare.com/restore. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, math can be quite a forbidding subject and traumatic for young people, but it doesn't need to be that way. We'll explore that notion in just a few minutes on 89.1 and WGLT.org. McLean County plans to devote about a third of revenue from recreational cannabis sales to mental health. County Board Chairman John McIntyre tells Eric Stock the county can't project how much money that might be. McIntyre says it can supplement what the county gets from sales tax revenue as it ramps up behavioral health initiatives.
What this really helps us, though, is if we do get any extra income, and it helps us sustain the programs that we have and initiate our at-risk youth psychiatric training, outpatient type. It could be not a lot of money, but any little bit helps when we're trying to do a separate fund that's dedicated specifically for mental health.
And it was a board member, Carlo Robustelli, who proposed the funding. And a similar proposal is in Governor J.B. Pritzker's budget proposal, with a quarter of the money coming from cannabis tax revenue to go toward mental health services in the state. That came a day later, I should mention.
Yeah.
It's new revenue for the county based on the tax revenue that we still don't know to what degree it's going to come in. Robustelli had said that this is better than potentially dipping into property tax revenue for mental health. Would you agree with his assessment that there's not enough money going into mental health as is?
Well, you know, part of our property tax money is dedicated through our health department. So you have to understand there's a different funding stream there. What the state gives us will be passed down to for substance abuse and for other psychiatric type of training and or services, and it'll go through grants that are awarded by the Board of Health. This is separate from the money that we use for sales tax or some of our initiatives for local. And this goes to providers, agency providers, who actually, you know, they apply for it. Send in there every year. The Board of Health meets and awards this money. And what the state will do, whatever they get done finally with their budget, will pass that money on. Through. So it will help with our property taxes dedicated for it.
Sheriff John Sandage also addressed the board, indicating that he had hoped the county would devote this windfall to help offset the cost of officer training. And I say windfall, not knowing how much that will be. This being a new expense for the county because of a drop in court fines and fees following a state law change intended to make these fines more fair and equitable. It's led to a significant drop in that revenue. Is that something the county would consider, or would it have to come from a different funding source or something that the sheriff's office will simply have to absorb?
Well, if the sheriff's office absorbs it, it's going to be the county that absorbs it, and that's probably the bottom line is one way or another that's going to get paid. Yeah, that was a situation where the state withdrew some money and some funding from fees, and so it's my hope that the state will put that back in along with their budget, and that will be taken care of. I know there's also possibilities of awarding some grants for that money to see it supply. So if we... You know, again, we don't know how much money we're going to come in from the tax for on the sale of cannabis. So we will apply whatever we have to do. It's not unusual for the state to make some changes in what they're doing with their funding, and then the local levels have to figure out how to deal with that and come up with the money. So we're hoping that the state comes through for us. I was down in Springfield yesterday for Governor Pritzker's budget address, and I was sitting there thinking, you know, it'd be really nice if the state legislatures would understand that training has got to continue for all our law enforcement people, and that it's got to be paid for, and that this will be done.
County Board Member Jacob Beard had requested the county lower the cannabis tax rate. The Finance Committee rejected that idea. His concern is that the tax rate will be so high that it will keep the cannabis black market thriving. The county's tax rate is just a small portion of that overall rate, but is that a concern the county should consider?
Yeah, well, I think it was considered, and I think it will be considered more in the future, but Board Member Beard I think he took a look at what some other states have done and what we have seen on a national level. Here's another thing that we're dealing with. It's a new situation for us. We're uncertain about that, but we feel like that the difference in the cost with the tax on anybody that's a member of the public that is going to become somebody who purchases cannabis on a recreational basis is not enough to have somebody go on to a black market type of situation. Of course, that's not legal, and so we have to do what's legal and what we follow that way too.
As we continue on Sound Ideas, I'm Eric Stock with John McIntyre, chairman of the McLean County Board. The board also approved a new insurance plan that includes protection against ransomware. It's becoming a real concern for businesses and governments. Some have already been targeted. How much of a concern is that for McLean County as you upped the level of protection to $3 million?
Exactly. It's a concern because everybody is concerned about the money that we don't want to be held up if somebody starts hacking into our system. It has been done. We had about $2 million in coverage. We just felt like we needed to have a little more than that, so if something happened, you know, can really shut down your system. And we have a county as large as ours, and the court system's counting on us, and there's so many things with our electronic justice information system that we just felt like we had to have more coverage than that. And so the difference in the cost was significant, but it's worth it.
It's about $50,000 total for cyber protection the county is paying for. Now, this is sort of on the back end, but on the front end, what is the county doing to prevent that kind of an attack?
We have a committee that's working on that. It's consisting of members from our law and justice system, our sheriff's office, state's attorney, county board members working to try to evaluate and upgrade. Our tech IT department is working on that as well, to continually trying to monitor our situation and provide improved security.
And board member William Casely had suggested the county is sort of putting a target on its back and publicly announcing how much insurance money it had. I guess for the sake of transparency, there's no real way around that, but is that a valid concern?
You know, that's an interesting situation we've got going with breaking into these, security systems and the high-tech thing in our computerized systems. I think the ones that are doing it are mostly internationally based. And if they're going to do it, I don't know if they're going to single us out, whether we've got $3 million or $2 million coverage. So I understand where Member Casely was coming from with this. I just don't feel that that's going to be enough incentive for an organization like that to get involved in cyber crime on our level. But we do have to have protection, so we want to be sure that we've got enough. Is that enough? Well, you know, $3 million, maybe, maybe not.
The county's overall insurance costs rose fairly sharply over the last year from about $707,000 to close to $864,000. An administration report had listed several factors, including workers' compensation premiums going up after fatality, a highway department worker. Mm-hmm. There was also a lawsuit settlement involving the county nursing home. How does the county absorb that additional cost for insurance?
The only way that we have to do that is actually just budget for it. And we know that there are going to be good years and bad years, and there's a risk management organization that assesses it for our insurance companies, and all we can do is be sure that we have the protection that we need. We have to be reasonable about it. Hopefully, you know, but what it is, it's basically a claims record, and what we have and what we have had to pay out, whether it's workman's comp or other types of things. And so they also will look at our history and see, you know, how we've done over the years. And hopefully, like a lot of the costs go up because of legal fees, et cetera. But I think overall we're doing all right. We just have to manage that. But we obviously we have to do it.
And as we continue on Sound Ideas with John McIntyre, chairman of the McLean County Board, the board's rules committee met recently to consider changing some of its rules for how it governs and how its boards operate. One idea that board vice chairman Jim Soldner had proposed would have the county establish caucuses for the parties, and that they could meet monthly or whenever needed to discuss legislative priorities or bills that are currently before the body. It would all be above board and in public view. Is that something that you would like to see?
Not really, Eric. On the state and national level, the caucuses are there, but we have the Open Meetings Act to consider, and many of the Open Meetings Act's stipulations don't pertain to the state level. You know, so they've kind of been able to be exempted for that. And for us to have a caucus for each party, number one, in my opinion, it promotes partisanship that we don't want at our level. I really truly believe, and I think you know, that I try to promote bipartisanship. I think our debate this week, even on the cannabis tax, went very well because of that. And you saw a vote on both sides of the aisles. But it's, I just don't think that a caucus is a good idea on the local level. I'll tell you why. Number one, we would have to adhere to the Open Meetings Act. We would have to post a public meeting. Anyone could come to it. Well, obviously, the idea of a caucus is to get people to sedge together on what they're doing to plan, make a plan. I think that promotes partisanship. We would have to dedicate a county board staff member to take minutes of the meeting. We would have to publish the meeting, or else we're violating Open Meetings Act, and that just, it makes no sense to do that.
That is McLean County Board Chairman John McIntyre with Eric Stock. McIntyre says he does not think there's enough support on the county board to hold caucuses, but the administration is looking to how they work in the few counties that have them.
Sometimes the universe sends you a sign. Because we all need a push sometimes, and if you've been waiting for a nudge to start paying closer attention to the upcoming election, here it is. Morning Edition from NPR News will get you up to speed and keeps you informed with the updates you need every weekday. Some things are too important to wait for. 2020 election, it's time to listen.
I'm GLT Morning Edition host John Norton. Join me weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. on GLT.
Support for WGLT comes from the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, presenting The Magic of Bill Blagg, live, interactive, and jaw-dropping illusions that will leave the whole family rubbing their eyes in disbelief. Sunday, February 23rd. Tickets at artsblooming.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, we'll tell you about a new program to help people coming out of prison navigate the difficult transition back into life outside of the bars. Eugenia Cheng sees a lot more than numbers and equations when she looks at the world of math. Cheng is the famed scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, where she teaches math to art students. that has given her a unique view on why some people have a math phobia and how to break through it. During a recent stop at Illinois State University, Cheng spoke to WGLT student reporter Tiffany Jackson about her own identity. She grew up in the UK, the daughter of immigrants from Hong Kong, surrounded by white people in rural England.
It definitely gave me an understanding of what it's like to be different. And I think that really helped me because I'm so often in a minority in many rooms that I'm in. So I'm a woman in a very male-dominated field. But I never really was too bothered by that when I was younger. Of course, now we talk about these things a lot more and we emphasize them, so I think about it. But at the time, I think I was used to being the odd one out a lot of the time. And I think that there are two ways you can respond to, well, many ways, but some people try desperately to fit in. But I think that I didn't. And so I was sort of used to sticking out. So I had a great education. I was very lucky. It was quite idyllic and quiet. And now I live in a very different place in Chicago, which is so different from the little village that I grew up in.
When it comes to pursuing a passion, everybody has that aha moment where they say, okay, I want to pursue this. This is my area of interest. So what was yours?
You know, I was so young. I've loved math and music since I was so young. I don't really exactly remember one specific aha moment. But what I do remember is a moment when I was about 16 and I was deciding what to do at university. Because in the UK, you have to decide really early what subject to study. And I had always thought I was going to study math. And then I had this really great piano lesson. I thought, oh, maybe I want to do music. And I thought about it for maybe all of 15 minutes. And I thought, you know, it's just that math seemed to me a better foundation for having a decent career in future. And that's not to say that you can't have a decent career in music, but I feel like there's a much bigger drop-off, that you're either the greatest pianist in the world or you're kind of really struggling. Whereas with math, you don't have to be the really greatest. There are all sorts of other things you can do. And I knew I wasn't going to be the greatest pianist. I knew I wasn't going to be the greatest mathematician either, but it just seemed that there were more things that I could do and that I could carry on playing the piano, which I do. Whereas making a living from playing the piano and then doing math on the side seemed pretty implausible as an option. So I'm glad I made that choice, and I'm glad that I stuck to it, because when I was young, I believed that I could do many things as an adult. And then I got a bit older, and then I learnt the supposed common wisdom that you have to focus and you have to concentrate on one thing. And I didn't like concentrating on one thing. And so now I've gone back to doing many things and I'm much happier.
Do you think math phobia is a real thing? And if so, is there a certain group of people who are more affected by it?
I do think math phobia is a real thing. And I think some people like to call it math trauma. And I think that's a good thing to think about because it comes from experiences. I don't think anyone is born with math phobia. In fact, I've done a lot of work in elementary schools. And 5 and 6 year olds, I've never really seen any math phobia in 5 and 6 year olds. You know, the teacher says that we're going to do math and everyone goes, yeah! Gets really excited because they haven't been traumatized yet. And yet somehow between there and adulthood, some people do okay and some people get traumatized. And I think it's partly to do with the things that the children like doing and to also how it's presented. So if it's presented in a way that's all about right and wrong answers, then inevitably children who don't get so many of the right answers will start feeling bad about themselves because no one likes being told they're wrong. And then those children are likely to drift towards subjects where you can't be wrong, like writing or drawing or painting or dancing or playing music or something. Whereas children who tend to get the right answer are much more likely to go, oh, I like this, and then keep going until a point where they stop getting the right answer. So people tell me often that they were okay with math until, and then something happened, and then they were quite good at it, and then they couldn't do it anymore, and then they started hating it. So I think that that happens quite often, which is a real shame, because I think, honestly, that math in the end is not just about getting the right answer. It's about exploring and imagining different possible answers, and that seems to get lost, unfortunately.
So what turns people off about math? You know, many girls and women of color especially, they say that they don't like it. Why do you think that is?
It's many reasons, and some of it is to do with stereotype threat. So, of course, Asians do not have the same kind of stereotype threat. Asians have the opposite, which is everyone assuming that they're going to be good at math, which is also dehumanizing, but it's not nearly as bad as the assumption that you won't be able to do it. And if someone assumes you won't be able to do it, then certain types of people will go, right, I'll show you, I can do it. And other types of people will go, oh, well, I won't do it then. And I think that in my experience, many girls are more likely to go, okay, well, I won't try. And many more boys are likely to go, right, I'm going to show you. And I think that that's a real problem. And it shows that telling people in advance what you think they can and can't do is a very destructive idea. And sometimes people talk about imposter syndrome, where some people think that, you know, they don't deserve to be here. And I think that we should focus not just on imposter syndrome, but the fact that people sometimes, especially women and women of color, have actually been told that they don't deserve to be there. They're not imagining it in their head. It's people actually telling them. And I don't think that's the same as imposter syndrome. And I meet many girls, unfortunately, who of color, who say that maybe their parents don't think that they're very good at math, or that their dad told them that they'll never be able to do it. And that makes me really sad, because quite often they take on that belief. And so I think that it's really important, especially as parents and educators, not to say those kinds of things. And sometimes it's not that. Sometimes it's that parents say that they're not good at math. And often it's mothers saying, oh, well, I'm no good at math. And that's almost like giving permission to not be good at math, or even to make it cool. Because young children especially often, you know, of course older children want to do opposite things from their parents, but young children see what their parents are doing and often want to do those things. And so if their parents go, oh, well, I'm no good at math, then the child is much more likely to go, oh, it doesn't matter then, I don't have to do this.
So how did you become interested in this issue, the accessibility of math?
I've always been interested in the accessibility of everything through education. And I think that my piano teacher really instilled in me the belief that education is really important, and that if you know something, it's really important to share it. And that comes from a general belief that if you have something and you're fortunate, then it's really important to share that with people who are less fortunate. And I found math fairly straightforward at school, and I always felt that it was my responsibility, therefore, to help other people who were struggling. And I think that's where it started, the idea that we should help people who are struggling, not just go, oh, well, you're no good at math. And it makes me sad when people don't like math or think that math isn't for them, because I love it so much. And so I want to share that with as many people as possible. And also, I do believe that education is a really amazing force for social justice, which I care about a lot. And I know that I had great advantages in life starting out. Many people have more advantages, but many people had fewer advantages. And so I want to recognize that and make good use of it. And I was taught in my education that we'd been given advantages in life, and that it was really important for us to do something worthwhile with that. And that's why I feel that it's important to bring that to more people, because that shouldn't be something that's only available to some people. That should be available to all people. And I especially think that math is a really amazingly empowering thing. One of the reasons that I think I'm a confident woman is that I'm a mathematician. And just knowing that I can do math, it kind of gives me an extra piece of confidence. And that because math can open so many doors, I think it's a really amazing... You don't have to buy loads of expensive equipment to be able to do math. And so I think that it can be a really powerful force for social justice to help people raise themselves up or make progress through the unfortunately oppressive forces of society.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Tiffany Jackson. I'm in the studio with Dr. Eugenia Chen, who is a mathematician aiming to rid the world of math phobia. So your first popular book, How to Bake Pie, was published back in 2015. Could you tell us a little bit about that and what inspired you to write the book?
That book, in a way, was my dream of a textbook for a liberal arts math course that I never thought I would have a chance to teach. And I had spent years talking to non-mathematicians about my research, because I love talking to people, and I love talking to people who do all sorts of things, and I love talking about the things I'm passionate about, including my research. Of course, it's quite difficult to talk about your research, math research, to non-mathematicians. So I found all sorts of ways of talking about it by analogy and by telling stories. And this turned into that book. And I never thought that I would get to teach it. But now I do, because I had the amazing opportunity to teach it to art students. And once I had a chance to teach a liberal arts math course to art students, I thought, wow, I've already written the textbook in advance. So that's how that book came about.
So do you think being a mathematical thinker changes the way you think about other problems or things in life? Do you apply that same skill set to your personal or social life?
Yes, I do think that being trained in mathematical thinking affects how I think about everything. It means that I've always got that basis. It doesn't mean I'm thinking about math all the time, but it's like a philosophy or an ideology, a way of thinking to get to the heart of things and find clarity about situations. And that's really what my last book, The Art of Logic, was about, because I realized I was using mathematical thinking to understand political arguments and that it was helping me understand the political arguments more than I could see being generally done in a widespread way. Because there's a lot of horror. Understandably, there's a lot of horror about what other people think these days, but there's horror from all sides about what other people think. So we may be horrified about what someone else thinks, and they're equally horrified about what we think. But when I see those arguments going on, I can always understand what everyone thinks. And I feel that it's actually mathematical analysis and the discipline of mathematical thinking and abstraction that helps me do that. And I was almost quite surprised by that myself. But then I realized that it's from that discipline that I've been so trained in, and that it was way more widely applicable than even I thought. Because there's an idea that math is all about numbers and equations and that it's useful for science and engineering and things. And I always thought my research had a very long knock-on effect, that eventually it would be useful to society, but in a really long time. And then I realized that actually it was useful to me now in just understanding other people.
So there is a strain of politics that is very anti-intellectual, anti-liberal elite, the Sarah Palin type versus the Barack Obama type. Mm-hmm. As someone who lives in this world, what do you make of that? Does that trouble you?
It does trouble me. And I think the important thing to do is understand it rather than immediately declaring that the other people are wrong. So it's clear which part side of that I fall into. And I think it's important to understand why some people are very skeptical about college and about intellectuals, because there does seem to be a large degree of agreement among certain groups of intellectual. But that doesn't mean that it's a conspiracy, and it doesn't mean that people are just brainwashing. It means that we have a framework for how to agree about things, and that the framework is working. And the fact that we have failed to convince everyone of that, I think, shows that education is failing. That if, for example, some people grow up thinking that scientists only agree with each other because of a conspiracy, that's a real problem, and that we as educators need to do better.
That's mathematician, pianist, and teacher Eugenia Chang speaking with WGLT student reporter Tiffany Jackson. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, we urge you not to reject the All-American Rejects. Hear their music in just a few minutes. People released from prison or jail can now take advantage of a new housing program in Champaign. The program also tries to help residents find jobs and health care. Lee Gaines reports research shows there is a large need for supportive housing for people coming out of Illinois prisons. The need is largely unaddressed.
Every year, 28,000 people are released from Illinois prisons. Now, four of them will live in a modest five-bedroom home in a Champaign residential neighborhood. Vincent Andujo gives me a tour of the place.
And so this is one of the rooms. We can go next door and see. Everyone you see with a bed, with a carpet and a dresser and a nightstand and all that, I think that is the standard.
But residents get more than just a bed and a dresser. These men will get a chance to fulfill their goals. In fact, the house already has its first resident. He didn't want to talk to me for this story. The Champaign group First Followers runs the house. Many of the people supporting the residents also spent time in prison. They provide help with writing a resume or tutoring. Tamika Davis Nunez says that would have helped her. Davis Nunez spent 8 years in prison. She was released in 2008. Like many others, she ended up at a halfway house.
And so that was like the scariest moments of my life because I had nothing and nobody to guide me.
Davis Nunez now works for First Followers, and she's tutoring the home's first resident. Davis Nunez says that kind of support is key to a successful reentry.
I don't think that a person that's done 25 years could ever even think about getting acclimated back into society without the help, without the support. If you do not have support, there is no way. That's why a lot of people end up going back to prison.
Experts agree. Research shows providing supportive housing for people leaving prison or jail could save Illinois more than $100 million per year because fewer people would return to prison. Jennifer Vollenkatz says most people leaving prison have to figure out housing on their own.
And they're walking out the door typically with, you know, a bus ticket and $10 and the clothes on their back that they got issued from the prison as they were released.
Vollenkatz is the executive director of the John Howard Association, an Illinois prison watchdog group. Nearly 40% of people who leave Illinois prisons return within 3 years. One reason, there's not enough housing and support. Vollenkatz says it's cheaper to house people outside of prison.
So anytime we can start investing in helping people be successful outside of prison, you know, long term, we're saving money.
Vollenkatz says that while there are upfront costs associated with this kind of housing, it's worth it. James Kilgore agrees. He's co-founder of the First Followers Group in Champaign. Kilgore knows this new facility will hardly make a dent in the number of homes needed. But he says that's not really the point. People have to apply to live in this house, and there are some specific requirements. Kilgore says they're looking for people with plans and goals for their future.
We're trying to build, you know, a smallish kind of cohort of people who can have an impact well beyond their numbers.
James Kilgore says if they find the right residents, the men will make the case for investment in programs like this. Kilgore spent time in prison, and he knows there are people behind bars with dreams. Now he wants to help with the support they need to make at least some part of those dreams come true. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
And you're listening to 89.1 and WGLT.org. Bloomington Normal's only locally owned and operated broadcast media outlet. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Touring the country with bandmates on the strength of major record label releases can sound glamorous. Guitarist Mike Kennedy of the All-American Rejects said 15 years of incessant touring put a serious ding in the excitement for the Oklahoma-born pop rock quartet. So much so, the band went on a hiatus after touring in support of their 2012 album, Kids in the Street, to take stock of everything. They did catch their breath enough to rethink how to move forward as a band. Eventually, four new singles, written and recorded. Kennedy tells WGLT's John Norton, none were targeted for an album.
And yeah, at the end of the day, we're like, this is cool. Let's just release singles and, you know, play a few shows here and there. And so that's kind of what we've been doing for our own mental health, to not do necessarily the grind of a normal album cycle.
Was it also partly to let your fans know that, hey, we are still here, we haven't broken up, stick with us, we got something coming maybe?
Yeah, totally. It's a weird thing where if you don't put out an album, it seems like the general kind of like machinery of press and stuff kind of considers you not doing something.
Right.
Even though, which we think it's funny because even if we did do an album, they'd probably only concentrate on the singles anyway. But it's annoying that, you know, we're putting something out there, but it doesn't quite get the attention as if we did an album. But same time, it's like, we don't want to commit to doing all the work that's involved in an album. But, you know, we still enjoy it. We still are really good friends and love playing together. So it's one of those things where, I don't know, we should probably be smart like a lot of bands and just say we broke up so we can eventually get back together.
Let's move a couple of years now into the future. You released an EP last year. It's called Send Her to Heaven. And there's the title track, there's Gen Y, and there's Demons on this EP. You released it on Epitaph Records. Now, does this mean you are signed to Epitaph, or is this just a license to this label?
Yeah, it was just kind of a one-off thing because we'd had, when we did the Sweat single, we'd done all the songs from Send Her to Heaven at the same time as we did the Sweat single.
Oh, okay.
And that fulfilled our Interscope contract. So we're, for the first time since 2002, free agents. I've met Brett many years ago, who runs Epitaph, you know, and we all grew up listening to bands on Epitaph. And so it's kind of like that's a cool opportunity to like finally work with someone else and see what happens. And so, yeah, so it's kind of just like a one-off thing, but it was a fun thing to be able to get to have that logo on a record that I got to play on.
Well, that's what I was wondering, because at one point in your life, 20 years ago, that would have been, wow, Epitaph Records. So it's still a cool thing for you guys.
Yeah, it was definitely kind of like a dream fulfilled. And everyone there was great, and they did a great job. It was a lot of fun.
Rock music landscape is quite different today than it was 20 years ago when you guys were just out of high school and getting this band going. Do you guys feeling that your sound needs to evolve, or are you still right where you want to be? How does that internally working for you guys?
Well, I think with us, one of our kind of issues we've always faced when we put out a new record is that I think, you know, we've never tried to stay in one certain pocket. And I think, you know, if you go through our catalog, like each record definitely kind of has its own personality. And we've definitely burned a lot of fans with each record, but also gained a lot of new fans. I don't know. I feel like we've never tried to box ourselves into anything. And at this point, it's kind of the same thing. We just go in and write whatever's, you know, just in our heads at that moment. And, you know, whatever style, whatever anything, whatever instruments we use, that's just what comes out.
Talking with Mike Kennedy of All American Rejects here on WGLT's Sound Ideas. You guys are still relatively young, despite the fact that you are two decades into this career, and you guys, almost right out of high school, hit it pretty big almost right away. But like I said, you're still relatively young. With the side projects you guys have going, you know, Tyson's doing acting, you've got your own recording studio, you're producing. How do you fit all of this together as far as your side projects and the band itself?
Like, as far as like touring, I mean, we're still a machine, so like we can go a few months without playing, and then we get together, and it's like we do a 30-minute sound check, and we're right back in like lockstep, good to go. And then with the writing, it's just kind of, yeah, like when we did Send Her to Heaven and Sweat, we did that in a different way than we had before, which is usually we do, you know, haul ourselves up and beat through the songs and dedicate our lives to that. And this was an example of, okay, we got the songs in a skeletal form, let's just hit the studio and give ourselves like one or two days a song and just do it and see what happens. And it worked, and it worked pretty well. So I think we're at this point now where we can be a little more expeditious about how we work. You know, we all live in different cities, and so it is tougher to get together. But now I think we've gotten to a point where we know how to get together and make it work so that we are able to balance our home lives or our other interests with doing the band.
Mike, when you guys first started, you worked with Jimmy Iovine really early on. He's one of the great record producers, one of the great record label men of the last 50 years, right? How important was Jimmy to your development? And you mentioned he was kind of a champion of you guys. How important was that?
He was very important for us. Yeah, like the first record came out on DreamWorks, and we had Swing Swing that was like a decent hit off of that. And then DreamWorks was purchased by Interscope. So that was when we, Move Along was the first time we dealt with Jimmy. You know, he was insistent that Dirty Little Secret be the first single off of Move Along. We all kind of wanted it to be Move Along, the song. You know, obviously we were like, he's the head, let him make these decisions. Tell me all that you're thrown away. Find out games you don't want to play. You are the only one that needs to know. I'll keep you my dirty little secret. It's funny because at first Dirty Little Secret wasn't doing so well. It was like by his pure will that it became a hit. Like he was... We have these stories from our A&R guy about being in these meetings where he's like, this is an effing hit, make it a hit, and like yelling at all their radio people. And they eventually, it took a while, but they did it.
Well, I have talked to a number of artists who have had both success and some bad stories to tell about working with bigger record labels. And it sounds like you guys had a pretty good experience working with Jimmy Iovine with Interscope Records.
Yeah, we had a good family there for like almost the entire time. You know, with Kids in the Street, there was like a lot of turnover right as that record came out. And that was kind of, that was a bummer because it was like all these people we'd been working with for almost 10 years were suddenly gone. And, you know, we didn't have that champion at the label anymore. And that was when we got the feeling of what you always hear the negative stuff about a major label, in that there's turnover. There's not the same people there as when you sign, you know. But we had a good run of almost 10 years with a lot of the same people, and they all were amazing for us. And, yeah, we had good experiences, unlike when you hear a lot of bands talking about major labels.
Mike Kennedy of the All-American Rejects speaking with WGLT's John Norton. The All-American Rejects will headline Illinois Wesleyan University's big show at the Shirk Center on Saturday. Discover local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the WGLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from Eric Stock, John Norton, and Tiffany Jackson. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Here's some more of the All-American Rejects. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.